I feel, as a psychoanalyst, one has to respond to the world. We can't just simply, personally, I don't feel, I've never been able to simply remain in my consulting room, although that has always been vitally important for my identity and thinking. But nonetheless, we can't simply, I just feel that's in my bones, both when I worked in the health service, but now that I'm totally private and see children and families, one can't turn a blind eye to what's going on in the world. And there's a lot of awful things going on, a lot of genocides, a lot of the similar kind of processes that were seen in the Holocaust, that were seen in slavery, are continuing. They're continuing. We need to stand up. We need to say what's going on. We need to tell people, look, these are the elements. In America, they came close to disaster with what happened with the Capitol riot and so on. We came close with populist movements here. But luckily, our democratic structures, I think, in the end, have been fairly resilient, been able to stand up with all the skepticism one may have to some of these destructive forces. But other places are not so able to. And so it was a sense of feeling analysts can't simply keep quiet.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Roger Kennedy. This is actually my second conversation with Dr. Kennedy. He and I spoke a bit over 2 years ago in episode 72 entitled The Musicality of Psychoanalysis. And today's topic is a good deal different than that. He has written in the past on the issue of tolerance, and he continues his interest in tolerance, but now more focused on evil. And the name of the book that we discuss is The Evil Imagination, Understanding and Resisting Destructive Forces. And he makes a point of addressing the meaning and purpose of resisting destructive forces. We define evil. His two case examples, as it were, for evil writ large are the Holocaust and what he calls British American slavery. We go into both of those at some length. And he also shares with us his personal family story in relation to the Holocaust, as well as the origin of his last name. Dr. Kennedy is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and an adult psychoanalyst. He was a National Health Service consultant in charge of the family unit at the Casale Hospital for over 30 years. He's now in private practice. He was chair of the child and family practice in Bloomsbury and is still a director there.
He is a training analyst. He sees adults for analysis and therapy, as well as children, families, and parents at his clinic. He is past president of the British Psychoanalytical Society, and he is a well-known expert witness in the family courts. He has written 14 previous books published on psychoanalysis, interdisciplinary studies, and child, family, and court work, as well as many papers. And as I mentioned, he has a strong interest in music and how the musicality of analysis is something important to him to listen to. I found both his book and our conversation to be important and touching. At the end, he shares with us the source of his life's work, the meaning to him of resisting evil, of the importance of remaining human despite pressures to the contrary in all of us and outside of all of us. And I hope you find this as important and powerful as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Roger Kennedy.
Roger, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here.
I'm very glad to be here again, Harvey. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. This is our second visit. Your first interview was around your book on music, which I recommend and will be listed in the show notes. But this book is on a quite different topic. It's on evil. And to introduce it, let me say that we as people, and certainly as analysts, are very familiar with evil, as we are with love and beauty. We're familiar with evil writ large on the international political arena, as we speak. In multiple settings in this world we're living in, there is evil being perpetrated. And also on the intimate level, as captured in the powerful phrasing of Len Shengold, who coined the term soul murder. But what I enjoyed about your book were a number of things, but in particular that not only do you speak about evil as it lives in these small and large spaces, but you draw our attention to the interface between them. That is, that it is the space between and connecting the intrapsychic and the interpersonal and the international. That's where evil lives in both directions, each space affecting the other. And that's what's so important for us to appreciate, not to get stuck in any one of the arenas. Now, I want to read a few quotes to start our conversation off. The first is your definition of evil. You write, quote, "It is the annihilation of the human subject, where human otherness and agency is psychologically denied and or physically eliminated. At such times, the human subject becomes invaded by the other. Subject relations are canceled, and there is a denial or destruction of the gift of otherness," which is that last phrase caught my eye, the gift of otherness, which is really what you elaborate, the meaning of otherness and how it can be a gift and how it can turn into a prejudice. Now, your book is broad. You approach the subject of evil from many perspectives. You talk about it from the point of view of the neurosciences, of philosophy, and Shakespeare, with a special emphasis on Macbeth. And we're not going to discuss those areas, but I do want to whet the appetite of the listener by reading a quote that you included. It's from Peter Hall, who was the founder of the Royal Shakespeare Company, and he comments on Macbeth and says the following. "Macbeth is the most thoroughgoing study of evil that I know in dramatic literature. Evil in every sense, cosmic sickness, personal neurosis, the consequence of sin, the repentance of sin, blood leading to more blood, and that in a way leading inevitably to regeneration. I find it the most metaphysical of Shakespeare's plays, an unblinking look at the nature of evil in the person and in the state and in the cosmos."
As it is said, the price of admission for the book is just that chapter on Macbeth. It's really a gem. But we're going to focus on the psychoanalytic point of view. And you have a warning to analysts who work with patients who've been touched by evil. And I will read this warning. You write, "In order to treat psychoanalytically those who have been subjected to major trauma, such as severe abuse, it is necessary, or anyway inevitable, that the analyst becomes caught up directly or indirectly with the abusing experience. One has to touch evil before it can be neutralized, minimalized, or resisted, so as to help the patient extricate themselves from the power of the past. But this is not an easy thing to do, and means that the analyst must bear difficult experiences when the analysis gets close to the traumatic core of the patient." And you go on to say that it not only is working with patients who've been touched by evil difficult, but also studying it is difficult. And you say that in researching the book, you could only read about it for an hour at a time before you had to put it down and turn to something more comforting, more life-affirming. With that as an overall introduction, Roger, start us off. Tell us about evil, and we'll include in that eventually what brought you to study this. But let's talk about it first from the individual point of view, and then we'll get to the group experience.
Well, you kind of summarized it rather well, I must say. I want to emphasize the book although you've emphasized the working with people who've been abused and the need to touch the destructiveness and the evil in a patient or that they've been subjected to, the book is also aimed at looking how we may resist evil, how individuals and also groups can resist it. So it's not just a litany of awfulness. The idea is to see how otherness can also be protected, and how what we can learn from those who've managed to resist evil as individuals or as groups. But the emphasis, say, individually, and I do kind of try to look at the evil and destructiveness across a variety of areas, is really about how the human subject becomes subject to excessively cruel external forces rather than subject of their own actions. It's basically, my approach has been for years really, I would call it a subject relations approach, looking at the sensibilities between one person and another and how they interact. So that's where I come from, and that's why I try to look at this area psychologically in a slightly different way to how it's been approached before. Of course, one could learn from individual psychopaths, criminals, where evil is obvious in a sense, when they've done horrendous acts. But the aim of the book and my curiosity was, that's fine, but what makes ordinary people, ordinary individuals, undertake evil acts, become involved in genocide? Why did millions of Germans become caught up as well in evil acts? It's not about psychopathology, they're individual psychopathology. There's an interaction quite often between individual psychopathology and society, but what I wanted to look at is how ordinary people get caught up in a network of perverse relations and easily lose their sense of self and their superego and become morally corrupted. There's a real overturning of morality.
Well, that's the question. When you and I first started speaking about this, we thought we'd have a title, which is Why Ordinary People Do Terrible Things. But we decided not to use that because we knew we didn't have an answer to that. There are sort of like formulaic answers that looked at individually about people who had, you know, insecure attachments or their child rearing was brutal. And not to eliminate that as a contribution, but it's clearly not sufficient. It takes some kind of interface between an individual vulnerability and a structural stimulation, a social stimulation, That's my sense, and that's, I think that's what you conclude, yeah?
Yes, and I think what the psychoanalytic perspective can add is some understanding of the attack on subjectivity and where it comes from and where it links into all these other areas. The literature on evil is very much philosophical or historical or social. There are the classic experiments, social psychology experiments, like the Milgram experiments with shocks were given, you know, under experimental conditions by students, thinking they were just, this was part of an experiment, and people went all the way and apparently killed people with that. But what wasn't looked at was the transference to the supposed scientist doing the experiments. So very often in the literature, there's little account of the fantasies of the relationships and the unconscious forces that really also go on, that help to begin to explain why people do participate in terrible things as individuals or in groups. So it was my attempt, and it's a very complex field, and it does require a multidisciplinary approach to try and come up with some ideas. Certainly, psychoanalytically, an overall theme, I think, from the analytic literature about evil is that for a variety of reasons, including trauma, specific perverse fantasies, participation in groups and powerful social forces, I mean, evil acts over and over again to eliminate otherness. You know, the bonds uniting people in an intimate, well, you know, like Buber's I-Thou relationship. That then creates a moral vacuum where personal meaning and responsibility and human subjectivity and the owning of agency with a capacity for self-reflectiveness and respect for others is weakened. And I think under certain social situations causes annihilation of the human subject. In addition, this is the complexity, one sees so often a degree of triumph or pleasure in the act of destructiveness. So often the benefits, as it were, of some of the fascist right-wing ideologies isn't just simply to go around being nasty to people. It also offers this fantasy of a new world, apocalyptic violence, where killing to heal, Robert J. Lifton called it, or the Nazis to create a new world order. So these very primitive fantasies get stirred up, and various analysts have looked at this from various perspectives, which I cover in the book.
Yes.
Asgeir Smergel, Werner Boehleber, for example. Werner examines how unconscious fantasies of purity, unity, and violence have a significant contribution in, for example, in fundamentalism and anti-Semitism. What I found interesting in his work is that these unconscious desires can attach themselves very easily to national and ethnic ideologies, and particularly around notions of home and the body. For me, I have this concept of psychic home as crucial to human identity, the sense of belonging internally to a sense of home. So that's when those ideologies create a false, or I call it a perverse psychic home, it is very seductive and very powerful. And so, again, I think this is where analysts have a contribution to make to try and understand, put into words what's going on, in the hope, of course, that by making unconscious conscious, one can at least help people see what's going on.
Yeah, you have a lovely section on tolerance, which we're going to get to. I want to underline your reference to Werner Boehleber, who I interviewed about his work on the mother infant purity, and how contaminants to that idealized purity have to be destroyed. And he uses that as a model of anti-Semitism. And it's, again, you mentioned the right wing, no doubt, but it's as we're seeing as we speak in Russia, from what passes for the left, anti-Semitism historically has always been subjected to violence from both the left and the right.
Oh, yes. No, it's undoubtedly the case, unfortunately.
And we certainly see that here in the States as well.
Yeah.
You talk about the capacity to mourn. They're all, I mean, I don't want to simplify by saying the othering, as you say it, othering as a gift, that is the pleasure of getting to know someone separate from you and being interested in them and wish to be known by them. That's what some would use the phrase, a depressive position, maturity, psychic development, to be to appreciate the other, versus the more paranoid version of the other, where they are dangerous and must be destroyed for you to survive. And you make that distinction without directly using those words throughout the book.
Yes, I mean, that's not particularly my orientation, as you know, is not particularly my intention, yeah. Although I find it quite useful. Trouble is, the problem with explaining things in that way, one has a ready-made answer, and rather than actually, the situation may be like that, and there's certainly elements of what one could call paranoia. It's no doubt at work in a lot of these very difficult situations, but it doesn't explain everything. And actually, if you look at babies in terms of evidence, the evidence is babies have a remarkable ability to know what's just and what isn't just in a very primitive way.
Isn't that something? Yes. Fairness is something that they locate in a very, very early age, far earlier than we would think. Yes, I know.
That's right.
I know.
Which is why I focused on the human imagination as the cause of the problem, not early paranoid schizoid or whatever.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't explain why millions of Germans, for example, or millions of Russians, let's stick to kind of the past. It's a bit easier. Why millions of Germans went along with the system? It's not because of the paranoid schizophrenia. It's about much more complex issues to do with later development, and I think the role of the human imagination, which brings together later on a whole host of fantasies and anxieties. I think that's more relevant, frankly.
Okay, and that's where you see the group process being so powerful, the yes. later development, yeah?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's no question about it's really where the individual comes into the group.
Right.
And I mean, it's easy to be mad in a group. It's very difficult to be sane if anybody's been in a large group, in a therapeutic large group, maintaining one's sanity is very difficult. And there's always a temptation to find a leader, to find a ready-made reductive answer rather than tolerate uncertainty.
Speaking of the past and the present, I read a quote not long ago, and we're recording this at the beginning of January 2023. One of the people who attacked the Capitol here in the States to try to overthrow the government was being sentenced before a judge. And in an effort to explain his behavior, which was violent, he said that in the midst of the group and with the intensity with which he was following his leader, he said he never felt as loved like that before in his life.
Yes.
Which was his explanation / excuse for what he attempted to do.
Freud really describes this rather well, you know, in analysis and the group analysis book, where the group process reduces rational thinking and creates a situation where the individual becomes loses their sense of the superego and love, really, the leader. It's described very well, basically, in that kind of in that dynamic. You could see that. It's a lovely description, actually. Roger Money Curl, who wrote some wonderful papers in the 40s about fascism and war, and he attended a Nazi rally with Goebbels and Hitler, and he described very much the powerful, after all the introductions and the repetitions and the kind of the light show and all that, the music, the basically loving the leader, loving all that. But in addition, of course, and this is the why he was successful and why Trump was successful in his own way, they offer a solution. It's a ridiculous solution very often. It may be mad, but it's a solution. Make Germany great again was Hitler, basically. You know, like make America great again. It offers hope for all the trauma, for all the disappointments, for losing the First World War. Of course, in addition, there's often a scapegoat. With Trump, it was Hillary Clinton. Do you remember the Senator?
Yes, we all remember. Yeah.
Yeah, you do more. Obviously, for you, it's more
yes,
your own
do.
History.
Right. Yeah.
We looked at it, thank God, from afar, though. We've had our own problems, to say the least. So, and with Hitler, of course, it was the Jews and the Slavs and the communists.
And the homosexuals and the Roma and the communists, sure, yeah.
Anybody.
Right, yeah. And the solution always has to be through the person, through the specialness of the leader.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you give in the book two, as it were, clinical examples. You emphasize the Holocaust, as you're doing right now, but you also bring in what you call British American slavery. Now, when I first came upon that, I was caught short because, again, referring to here in the States, we don't generally think of slavery under the category of British American slavery, but you do, and I learned something from it in doing so. And let me share with the listeners a quote where you describe this. You write, "Slavery has a long history, and the modern slave trade has involved several different European powers and included Arab and African interests. But the transatlantic slave trade had an important part to play in the early development of capitalism in the UK. Goods such as sugar, spices, tobacco, and then cotton, which were not available in European markets, soon became highly prized commodities for consumers, and the ability to employ cheap labor and use large areas of land for cultivation in the New World became highly desirable for British investors." You go on to say that British capitalism was a cause of the flourishing of the slave trade, not a consequence of the slave plantation development. Tell us about what led you to choose these two examples. There are many horrors in history, many genocides. What drew you to these two, and how do you see them both similar and different?
Yes. Well, I chose both of them, the Holocaust for more personal reasons because of my own Jewish background, but also because the resonances of the Holocaust are still with us, and there's more and more research on the Holocaust and Jewish resistance, for example, and the role of women as perpetrators. There's a whole lot of new evidence for, as more and more archives are opened about the Holocaust. It's not something that is simply stuck in the past, as it were. It still informs how we see things.
In fact, just to interrupt, I saw today that there is a new documentary that's coming out that emphasizes why so few of the perpetrators of the Holocaust were punished, and how the vast majority of the perpetrators lived prosperous and seemingly safe, comfortable lives, many of whom lived in England. It's not just in Argentina and Paraguay, as is commonly thought, but this documents in England being a center for these perpetrators. It's a long documentary, and just came out today, just to follow up on your notion that it's 80 years ago, but it's also today.
Yes. It's, of course, there were many reasons for that. There's a book, The Rat Line, by Philip Sands, all about how the Nazi perpetrators escaped or were helped by various of the Western allies and the church. And of course, it suited them with communism because they used a lot of the Nazi know-how in trying to deal with the communist threat. Actually, although ironically, I from what I've read, looked at, in East Germany, there were more Nazi perpetrators who were brought to trial by far than in the West, which is partly, I suppose, because the Russians had been so traumatized by their own loss of so many millions that they really wanted to take get justice. But it's true that so many didn't get to justice.
Right, but let me draw you to the British American slavery section because that's a unique contribution.
Yeah, and I thought, well, the other very much researched area of evil for which the British were very much responsible, let alone the Americans subsequently, was the slave trade. I was surprised that you were surprised that no one talked about British American slave trade. I know it's a different way of describing it, but for me, it's from our point of view, it's obvious.
Right, sure. Yes, I understand.
We were the awful people that started it, and we made a fortune out of it, and it's still now in our history. We've only just begun the process of mourning and taking some responsibility for this. It can at times reach ridiculous degrees with statues being thrown here and there, but one can appreciate it totally, the feelings around this. And it's still, racism is common to what happened to the Jews, and it's common to what happened to West Africans in the slave trade. So this is racism and all the perverse fantasies that go along with racism are common. There were differences, of course. The Jews in the Holocaust were certainly seen as less than human and became objectified and dehumanized, and the subjectivity annihilated prior and consequent to being as well as being physically annihilated. But with slave trade, the slaves needed to be kept alive by and large, because if you kill the slaves, it was bad for business. They were objects, commodities that the capitalism needed. But nonetheless, they were violently uprooted from home and community, desocialized and depersonalized, subject to what Orlando Patterson called psychic death. Certainly, various philosophers in the area of genocide have talked about psychic death being something that is common in genocide. So,
and by psychic death, you mean what?
That they may not be, they may be physically alive, but they're, as it were, they're cut off to a greater or less extent to their roots, to their ordinary social life. Of course, more and more research does show, first of all, how many slave rebellions there were, how many people, not just on the slave side, on the other side, the white community, were against it, various Methodist ministers and so on. So there was a lot of rebellion. And more and more has come out about that. And more, I think, from what I'm beginning to hear, about how many slaves kept hold of their culture. Obviously, music was one element, but also through oral means, verbal means, kept it going. But nonetheless, they were dehumanized and subject to incredible racist attacks. With women, you know, black women, their sexuality was also taken advantage, and that was attacked. The point is, with both the Holocaust and with slavery, we still see in everyday life it's the consequences. The trauma is still not being put to rest. We see it in the UK, in racism, for example, in the police. In many other areas of society, where some of the way that women, black women, are attacked and so on, has links, I think, to the Victorian past. So I thought these were two obvious areas, and there's been a lot of research with similarities and differences and resonances that can help us understand more about human evil. And slavery is still with us everywhere. Internationally, it's the most terrible existence of slavery, modern slavery.
Yes, it exists. People aren't, it seems to me, fully aware that slavery exists as we speak, there are large areas in various parts of the world where slavery is present, common, and unacknowledged.
When there's not what Stuart Hampshire, the philosopher, called procedural justice, where there's procedural justice, where there's there is a legal system, at least there's a chance, a proper legal system that works, unlike with Nazi Germany when it became perverted, unlike authoritarian regimes where there's no separateness of the legal regime from the regime itself. Procedural justice, which looks at or listens to the other side of every argument, that can be a protection against destructive evil. And where it fails, then there's a real risk that evil can flourish, and that may mean slavery continues without anybody noticing, human rights are undermined, and so on. Mm-hmm.
I think one of your contributions of your book is, like you said at the beginning, that you also introduce tolerance as an internal state, not to mention a societal state of mind, and you write the following about tolerance. This is a form of common human understanding requiring thought and imagination. There needs to be an obligation to protect free and open communication, both by enabling practices of tolerance, but also by paying attention to how intolerance can undermine free public communication. This involves a fundamental change in attitude of citizens towards their fellows, an act of positive imagination. Positive imagination. One could characterize this shift as providing what I have described as a home for otherness. Tolerance is not indifference. It is a much more active process involving the burden for those who hold different worldviews to make the effort to respect, if not fully understand, other worldviews. Home for otherness is going to be a shorthand that will stay with me. I mean, I learned many things from your book, but home for otherness is such a rich characterization of a remedy. Fill us in on your understanding of tolerance and what that phrase means for you.
Yes. Well, it is, as you say, shorthand. It kind of came into my head. But it grew out of two previous books. One was my book called Psychic Home, where the idea of psychic home being, as which I've mentioned before, as a vital element of human identity. I mean, and you can see it in people who are exiled. They may bring their home with them, and they may have different homes, or they may always feel a tension that their real home is somewhere else. I got that idea from a patient who had been in a boarding school and never felt their own home was a home, and felt, as a result of the analysis, she brought up this idea that the analysis she feels for the first time was her psychic home, which she began after years of work. So I kind of extended it. The next book then was on tolerance, tolerating strangers in intolerant times, which looked at the history of tolerance and intolerance going back in time. But I came up with basically the notion of subject tolerance as opposed to object tolerance, or you know, you can just tolerate something, which means you put up with, as opposed to subject tolerance, which is more active, in which you imagine the other point of view. And but it's a hard won process. It's not something that appears out of the blue, a bit like Desmond Tutu's resolution process in South Africa. It requires structures. It requires willingness on communities to get together, but they need to have a structure for this. And human beings simply, by the nature of, will simply not tolerate each other if you just put them together. They may or may not. But I imagined in that book that would have to have various structures to enable this to happen, so that one could have what you've reminded me of, a home for otherness. You accept otherness, but you have to have a home for it. It means you welcome it into your home, which is a kind of it's about hospitality. Jack Derrida called it, absolute hospitality, didn't he, or something like that. The idea of welcoming a stranger into your home and accepting them in. And it's not just a barren phrase. I think it's a powerful image of what we need to do.
One of the, speaking about powerful images in your book, you discuss La Chambonne.
Ah, yes.
Many of our listeners may be familiar with that, but many may not be. Why don't you share with us what that was and how that meets your criteria of hospitality, as it were?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the aim, as I said, the book was, this is all right, all, look at evil from the various aspects. It's here to stay. It's part of our landscape. We can't ignore it. You can't pretend it'll go away. So we need to resist it. We need to have structures to resist. We need to have procedural justice. But what can we learn from people in extreme situations, such as in war, who are able to resist? There have always been heroes. There are, you know, the few heroes that we hear about who and there are many heroes we don't hear about because they died. But there are certain key places, and there was this community, Le Chambon-sur-Rhône, in the south of France, that hid many Jews and got them out to Switzerland. And this was a Huguenot community, so a religious Protestant, but Huguenot community, and of course the Huguenots knew very well about persecution, who literally welcomed Jews into their homes, disguised them, enabled them to escape persecution. I should add that the evidence more and more, which I only really discovered more recently in France, that of course, though 25% of the Jewish population was sent to Auschwitz and other camps, including
just to be clear, I heard that it was 25%, did you say?
25% of the Jewish population, okay. Mm-hmm. Were sent to camps, as I say, including, in fact, one of my grandfather's brother, which we only discovered relatively recently. But 75% didn't. And I was talking to one of my cousins in France. I have quite a large French family. And he said, well, my grandparents, my father, because they were all hidden by peasants. And we survived because thanks to the ordinary citizens. But there are times when ordinary people in communities, usually, and supported, can resist evil forces. There was another Huguenot community in Holland, which otherwise didn't have a great reputation, I have to say, for helping the Jewish population. They also, despite the Anne Frank topic, the Dutch village of Nieuw-Vallander rescued Jews with a network of rescuers. And they also shared a common Protestant Calvinist religious tradition. Unlike Lutheranism, was opposed to anti-Semitism, and they respected the Hebrew Bible. And as well as having their own persecution, of course, in Catholic, but from their Catholic friends. So on the one hand, you have the heroic people, and they often have strong sense of moral certainty, often because they've been brought up with a strong ethos of some kind, often religious, not always, but often, or some other positive ideology. And research, I think, that was undertaken in the 50s in America showed that those who, non-Jews who helped, tended to have more altruism, basically. And it's not surprising. So these are models of what home for otherness is possible, and that the humankind is capable of resisting evil. And, of course, who knows what any of us would do under these circumstances. Mm.
So perhaps the title that we didn't use, What Makes Ordinary People Do Terrible Things, we should now include another title that we won't use, which is What Makes Ordinary People Do Heroic Things.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. They don't get so much publicity.
Right, yes. So, Roger, you mentioned at a few places that you have personal interest in this. That's my next question, which is, what brings you to the study of evil? And can you give the listeners a bit of a history about your last name?
Well, first of all, what brings me to the study of evil? First of all, I suppose it does follow from the previous work, from psychotolerance and intolerance. But also, I think, I feel, as a psychoanalyst, one has to respond to the world. We can't just simply, personally, I don't feel, I've never been able to simply remain in my consulting room, although that has always been vitally important for my identity and thinking. But nonetheless, we can't simply, I just feel that's in my bones, both when I worked in the health service, but now that I'm totally private and see children and families, one can't turn a blind eye to what's going on in the world. And there's a lot of awful things going on, a lot of genocides, a lot of the similar kind of processes that were seen in the Holocaust, that were seen in slavery, are continuing. They're continuing. It's we need to stand up. We need to say what's going on. We need to tell people, look, these are the elements. In America, they came close to disaster with, you know, with what happened with the Capitol riot and so on. We came close with populist movements here. But luckily, our democratic structures, I think, in the end, have been fairly resilient, been able to stand up with all the skepticism one may have to some of these destructive forces. But other places are not so able to. And so it was a sense of feeling analysts can't simply keep quiet. In terms of the specifics of the Jewish thing, that's my background. I think I mentioned in the previous chat we had, I can't remember now, but my father, his brother, and all their cousins went into the army and the navy or submarines in the Second World War with the name Kleinman. And they felt this was not a wise thing if they'd been caught. So they decided to change the name to Kennedy, which stuck. So we're the Jewish Kennedys. So, and we were subject, despite that, at school in the 50s, I and there was a group of Jewish children in the community in Arnold's Grove, with young parents with young children. There were a whole group of Jewish parents. It's now changed. It was then Cypriots and then others and then all kind of different minorities have taken over the same houses over the years. But we were subjected to, I called it in the book, low-grade anti-Semitism. I mean, it's not like it in Nazi Germany, but e.g., Jews weren't allowed to go to the religious instruction lesson on a Friday morning. We had to, and a Wednesday, I think it was, we had to go to the school hall. Jews to the hall. I didn't mind. I used to take a book or two and we had chats. It was quite pleasant in a way, but it was made very clear that we were other. And and then in the 50s, Jews weren't allowed to be part of various golf clubs. In medicine, I mean, I was much too young for that. I was only a boy, but I know from talking to colleagues and so on, at that time, to become a medical consultant as a Jew was very difficult. There were certain places that it was more possible, and I ended up going to one of those, University College Hospital, where it was more possible. But there was a Jewish quota. Mind you, in my day, there was medical school, there was a female quota of 25%.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. So there's all personal resonances for me. Also, I met members of my extended family who'd been to Auschwitz.
Who's been to what? I didn't hear the last
Auschwitz.
Word. Auschwitz, yeah. Yeah.
The father of one of my French cousins was was one of the tailors in Auschwitz. He survived by being a very talented tailor. My grandfather was a tailor, but he escaped in the First World War, came to England, and was his cousin was in France, and he went to Auschwitz. But he survived. He was a lovely man. Never talked about it, of course. I had various relatives that we used to have big family gatherings, and I remember one showed me his tattoo. I was a boy of about eight, I'd known about it. Can you show me your tattoo? I mean, terrible thing to ask. But he was a very nice man, and he wasn't had no problem about it, and he just showed me the tattoo. And that meant, of course, he survived. If you had a tattoo in Auschwitz or wherever, you survived because you were put to work.
You may survive, right. I can hear the thread with your family's past and what it meant to you and your work and commitment now. And let me close by reading the last sentence from your book, because it puts into words for me what it is you just said. You write, "While the effective resistance to evil and the power of the evil imagination usually requires networks of support, we all have an individual responsibility to see evil where it exists and keep hold of the human, however fragile." And that's what you're saying you've dedicated your life to, Roger, yeah?
Yes, yes. It sounds, yes, put like that. I'd like to think so. It sounds a bit...
Yeah. I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your work, for your inspiration, really, and for your passionate commitment to the struggle to stay human. I've learned from it. I imagine many people listening to you will learn from it as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Harvey. It's been a pleasure, and thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.